It is the 12th of February, and this is the cyber licensing IP class. I am pleased to let you know that all of the PowerPoints, with the exception of the days when I simply said who, what, where, why, when, and how, which really isn't a substantive set of slides, but all of the other slides and all of the audio recordings and links to all three of the online classes recordings are all now available through the Class Twin page. So the PowerPoints are in the PowerPoint tab, and where it says Class Recordings, that will link you over to a ClassCaster page where you will see links to all the recordings. When you click, those of you who maybe have not yet done the online recording, the online class, it may prompt you to install the Adobe Connect plugin or whatever. Just let that happen. But once you've done that, hold on a second. Once you've done that, you should have access to all that material. So if you have missed any classes or wish to review now, that would be a good time to do it. It is somewhat early to start talking about the final exam, but since I think people are beginning to ask about it and think about it, let me give you once again what I think we are doing here. Hang on a second. I did. So the final exam will be a 24-hour take-home exam. It will be posted to TWEN at the beginning of exam period this semester. It will be due no later than the final moment of the final scheduled exam, whatever day and date that time that is. You will have 24 hours from the time that you download it to upload your answers. The format of the final exam will be a series of exercises, questions, based on not only the substantive law that we've talked about, but the simulations that we will be beginning shortly. And among the kinds of tasks that you may be asked to do in the final exam might be to draft a licensing provision, to interpret or modify an agreement, to draft a memo or a letter to a client explaining certain provisions, explaining what they mean, what the client should think about them, and so on. Very much the kind of things that an attorney practicing licensing will have to handle. It will be completely open material. This is by no means a memorization exercise, since life isn't either. It will not be a group exercise. Some of the things we do over the course of the semester may be done in groups, but the final exam will most assuredly not be a group exercise. That is sort of as much as I can tell you now, but that's it. It will be, and it will not be designed to require 24 straight hours. That's not the point. But it will allow you more thought, consideration, and drafting than a single three-hour exam would. And it also means you could be a little more flexible with your own time management. Any questions about the final exam?
You know if we have to leave it open. I only took one where it was like a 24-hour time limit.
My understanding is the way TWEN works, and I've never taken an exam through TWEN, but I think you check it out, mm-hmm. right? And that starts the clock that by downloading the exam, and then you upload your final answer in good Who Wants to Be a Millionaire format, right? And that stops the clock. So it's not that, I don't believe that it's like the computer-based testing things. I think it's just when you download it, it starts the clock. When you upload your final response in Word format, please, nobody do Open Office. It just makes things all weird. Or some bizarre Mac thing. No offense to the Mac users, but since Turo doesn't buy me two computers, I have to make sure I can read what you give me. Anyway, so that's what we're going to do. It will be anonymous based on your test number. And as we get closer, I think you'll have a better sense of it, but there will be no surprises. Yep. Did you have a question? You can't stop the clock, so you have to pick your day. You don't have to be working all the time, but once you start that clock, you've got only 24 hours. Okay. Any other questions about the exam or other? Okay, I am assigning, hopefully, something fun. And this is not a short-term thing, but I do want to do this, and I would really like to have it generate some discussion. You will now find, under additional readings, on the Class 20 page, this. Cory Doctorow is a science fiction-ish author, and I only say he's science fiction-ish, because if science fiction is frequently fiction of the future, Cory Doctorow's future is about 30 seconds from now. He is not at all subtle about his views on things like intellectual property, but he makes it fun while he is telling you his views. So, Cory Doctorow is not a big fan of digital rights management. That is an understatement. And as part of his protest against digital rights management, he has arranged with his publishers, from the first book he wrote, that they allow him to make all of his books available legally, free of charge, for downloading and remixing. All of them. And what he does is he posts them and then people turn them into different formats. So, what I'd like to ask each of you to do, let's say sometime in the next, I'll come up with a date, but figure you have about 2 months to do this. And these are not long books. I'd like to have you pick one of these three novels. They're novels. They're young adult novels. And basically enough, they're not dystopian novels about young women trying to fight battles, which is apparently what all young adult novels are supposed to be about, unless they're werewolves these days. But they're young adult novels. They're not particularly sort of funky. No spaceships. Right. Of the three, Eastern Standard Tribe is by far the funkiest. Makers, very grounded. Pirate Cinema, which is the latest, also very grounded in slight future technology. They are all about licensing, all three. I would like to have you pick one of them. And when you click on one of these links, you'll end up at, you'll pardon the name, Cory Doctorow's website, which is craphound.com. I don't know why. I really don't know why. So here is, this is the link for the bookmakers. And when you scroll down, you have all these different formats that you may download it. If you have a Kindle or anything Kindle-ish, you can get a Mobi file and upload it to your Kindle. If you come to the page on a Kindle Fire, I think you could do that. Download directly to iPod, iPhone. I guess I don't know what format that is. So if you go to this, there are PDFs, plain text, lots of different formats. Pick your favorite one. Sometimes there are audio, although frequently the audiobooks actually, if you wish to pay for it, you're more than invited to. If you wish to listen to it, you may end up having to pay to listen to it, because most of the time the audiobooks are not free of charge. I'm sorry? Many libraries have some of these books as audiobooks, but in any event, I would really like you to read one, and then think of this as the Licensing IP Book Club. That we'll see how we break out, so pick one soon, and then maybe sort of break you out into groups for a class or half a class and talk about it, and then talk about what we learn, what we see about licensing from it. Corey's not a lawyer, but I think he's got real insight, and I think they could be fun. So of the three, just to give you a sense, Pirate Cinema is about movies and about creative remixing of movies and the near future, really today, legal restrictions on the art form of remixing movies. Makers, which I think of the three is my favorite, is about 3D printing and what 3D printing can enable commercially and non-commercially. You will notice, particularly in Makers, that one of the things Cory Doctorow loves is Disney World. Loves, loves, loves Disney World. Also Disneyland. But Disney comes up big time in Makers. An Eastern Standard Tribe, as I said, it's a little funkier, but it also involves music rights and licensing and IP owners versus IP consumers, etc., and entrepreneurs. You're welcome to read all of his other books, too. They're lots of fun if you're interested in virtual currencies and online gaming and the idea that real-world money and virtual money may have corresponding value. I recommend the game For the Win, the book For the Win, I should say. If you are particularly concerned about the surveillance state, start with Little Brother, and if you're not too scared by Little Brother, read its sequel. But these are licensing books. And I really would like to add a little interesting flair. Besides, I'm hoping that if we can get his attention, and I'm connected with him on Twitter, even though he's in England, it would be rather late at night. Maybe we can even get Corey to come in and Skype to us, which would kind of be cool. Anyway, so that's the additional readings that I'd like to, yep. So, Pirate Cinema, the summary, near future, British teenager kid who is taking all these classic films of a particular performer and remixing them, taking scenes from here and there to turn them into new things, and the legal challenges and problems he comes up against doing that, even though from his perspective and that of many other people, what he's doing is a new art form. So it's the creativity of the remix. I mean, sort of, I guess, in the music world, you have Danger Mouse, right? And that kind of methodology turned into movies. So if you're into kind of the movie world, I would say pick Pirate Cinema. If you're into the kind of techie 3D printing world, that's Makers. And if you're into bizarre, odd, near future music stuff, Eastern Standard Tribe. And while you're reading them, think about the choice that the author is making in making them available. Think about the publishers, and he talks in his introduction about the choice, his determination to make these all available legally, free of charge, with no restrictions on distribution, free of charge. The discussions he's had with publishers, and why he still thinks that people should and will buy the book. In fact, many of these books, between the chapters, he talks about his favorite bookstores. Most of the indie puns, many of them perhaps no longer there. But I just think I've gotten a lot of insight about licensing in reading these books. So it's an experiment. I didn't do this the last times I've taught this class, but I think it will be of value. And like I said, so the PowerPoints are there. And if you click on class recordings, you get to this page. Right. Once I fix the link, that is. You get to this page when I fix the link. And so you see the MP3s are the audio recordings. And if you click on those, you get to the Adobe Connect thing. And let's see if it works. Come on. And hopefully it works better than this does. There we go. I heard that.
Our recording. Thank you to those who were able to schedule and come into this makeup class today. As you know, and for the benefits of the recording.
So there's Robert, everybody.
licensing IP class.
He was the only one brave enough to turn on his camera once.
It's the 1st of February.
At some point, there's a dog barking in this, too.
The business of intellectual property.
That's okay. So there they are. So if you missed them, all three of them are there. Please do attend. Okay. All right. Close all tabs. By the way, so you used that for ALS. Licensing plays an important part in our choice of platforms for these classes. So you use Connect for ALS through, I think, we have 5 licenses in the building for Adobe Connect. And they are personal. I don't mean people paid for them ourselves, but they are by name. That's how Adobe licenses Connect. So I have one, because I do. And there are a few others, but those faculty members who want to use Connect, but who don't have the licenses, we have to work out under the license terms how we do that. We have another program called Zoom, which does much the same thing. And there are limits on the number of concurrent sessions and an outside number of participants. So we're kind of cobbling together solutions. And the challenge is licenses. The cost of licensing and the restrictions on the licenses.
They won't do the enterprise for the whole university.
Would they? Yes. Can we afford it? I mean, that's the, you know, this is not a revenue generating tool. This is overhead. It makes my life a lot easier. It makes your lives easier. There are some licenses we get access to, like, for example, Blackboard Connect. The Zoom license, I think we are utilizing Touro College's enterprise license, but the more we use, and also with Blackboard, we are entitled to use Touro College's enterprise license. But the more we use it, the higher the cost for the institution as a whole. So we need to be aware of that. We've got to deal with, and these are copyright licenses. This is a very relevant discussion. We've got to deal with licenses as an institution all the time. Everything we do with you may involve copyright licensing of some sort or another. So we have the online classes, right? We have issues of course packets and duplication rights. You may or may not be aware that one of the largest ever damages awards in a copyright infringement case was levied against Kinko's. Kinko's. Yes, Kinko's, because of academic course packets. As the case was brought, Kinko's, I don't remember whether it was a single, maybe it was Columbia, but Kinko's was in the business of duplicating course packets for universities. I don't know how much of that happens now. I know in the past we've had to use Barnes & Noble for the big course packets, and I don't know if we've renegotiated that here, but in many university towns, the students would go to the local copy shop to purchase and pick up their course packets of the photocopied articles and chapters and things like that.
Stony Brook has Kinko's on campus in the basement for that purpose.
Right.
They've downsized significantly since that doesn't go on.
So, but part of the reason why it doesn't go on is that Kinko's is much less willing to do it anymore. Because what happened was as follows. Actually, this will lead into our discussion today. So there is a certain amount of leeway, right? Because we were talking about this the other night. Let's get back to where we were. There's a certain amount of leeway in... we were going to get to what works made for hire. Okay, so let's leave that for now. In whether or not one may duplicate things for a not-for-profit academic purpose. As we'll see in a couple of minutes, the fair use defense, while not entirely clear-cut, lists among its factors to be considered the purpose of the use, whether it was not-for-profit, whether it was academic, educational uses and the like. And so, on a one-off basis, there's a reasonable argument if, for example, I wanted to hand out an article. There's a reasonable basis for me to feel comfortable saying that even though these articles are all copyrighted unless I get them from the U.S. government, that for the purposes of class, if I go and I photocopy the article and I hand it out, I'm probably okay on a one-time basis with fair use. And another factor in fair use is the burden of having to find the rights holder and get permission. So if I find an article today and I want to give it to you, I'm trying to figure that out. But that wasn't what was going on. Professors were using the same materials year after year. And Kinko's was duplicating the same materials year after year and marking them up. That was the deal. They provided the services, the students would pay for the packets, but there was a markup in that. And ultimately, the copyright holders sued Kinko's for facilitating this mass ongoing infringement without ever saying to the professors, you must obtain the rights here. And it wasn't a one-time thing. It was every year, year upon year, the same materials, the same materials. And Kinko's was slammed for tens of millions of dollars in infringement. They don't like doing course packets anymore. So it isn't as if professors have to track down every author, every publisher. You don't. There is the Copyright Clearance House, which is an initiative of various publishers allowing low-cost, one-stop clearance of materials. And we have a process here at Turo for those faculty members who do things like packets, that they need to notify the library staff what they're going to do. The library staff then reaches out to the Copyright Clearance House, obtains the rights. We pay probably a nominal fee. The way that works is those fees are then divided out pro rata based on how many, for each of the members, what percentage of the requests were for their materials. So it's divided among the members of the Copyright Clearance House. So we can now easily do this. Does everyone? Not so much. Maybe. I think most of us have just moved away from course packets in a lot of ways. I've for a long time gotten around this by simply providing links. I don't hand out the materials. I just say, go read it yourself. Or I assign something that's available on Lexis or Westlaw or online. There are a couple times I may hand out an article here and there, but by and large, I don't. So we have to deal with copyright on that front. We have to deal with copyright as creators, and it's sort of an interesting issue. We have to deal with copyright when we take our conferences and seminars and we post them online. We need to get clearance from those people who participated, other than faculty members, and on and on and on. So even an institution like this one, a small private law school nestled in the heart of Suffolk County, has to deal with copyright licensing issues all the time. And the risks are rather high. We, of course, have to deal with things like software licenses for the computers and for these computers and all of those things, and making sure that people aren't, using our network to host torrents of distribute movies and the like. There are certain kinds of connections that I think are blocked for the student wireless network. And I think certain large downloads are metered. At some point, your use will be curtailed, mostly because we don't want to be, first of all, it pulls down the network capabilities, but also we don't want to be the IP address of record to the outside world. Turo Law Center accused in mass music piracy scheme. No, thank you. It's not what we want to do. So copyright licensing turns out to be extremely relevant. There's also the creation of copyrighted materials and the school's ownership of them versus the independent work that we do. Now, I tell you, there isn't a lot of expressed concern among faculty members about ownership of their creative works. But those of us who publish outside could, in theory, run into some problems if we ever wanted to separate our identities from the schools. And that's because of this. This is a key provision in the copyright law. And this comes up in the case that you may have skimmed, I hope, in terms of the sculptor and the sculptured work. And what constitutes a work made for hire? That is the correct term. It's not a work for hire any more than a not-for-profit company should be described as a non-profit company. Lots of companies that are trying to be profitable are non-profit companies, but you want to talk about a work made for hire and a not-for-profit entity. So what is a work made for hire? You say that, but that's not what the case found, and why not? Why didn't the client own the sculpture? There's a key difference, right? What does the statute say about the conditions for that automatic transfer of ownership? What has to be true? It's not just doing work for someone. It's being employed by someone as an actual employee within the scope of his or her employment. Not a contractor. Not a temp. Not someone who's being paid on a 1099. Not someone doing work on a verbal agreement, either. This is an employee. So, you, for example, as law students, are not subject, this is not legal advice, but this is my personal opinion, are not subject to the work made for hire statutory transfer the way I would be to Touro Law Center. And even if you are a work-study employee, anybody here research assistant or work-study kinds of things? None of you have made it. Have you done any of that for law center? So you did. How were you paid? Were you paid as an employee or were you paid as a contractor?
I am an employee.
Okay, did you get a Touro? What did you get on the tax? Which tax form did they send you?
W-2.
They did send you a W-2. Okay, so those aren't 1099s, those are W-2s. Okay. Now that might change things, right? If you do something, so if you're a research assistant and you're being paid as an employee, then the work you write belongs not to you, or for that matter to the professor with whom you're working, but to the school.
Over the last summer, I worked for a Huntington town attorney. I got Touro Law School projects.
Because it was through a fellowship or something?
It was through the federal work study.
Okay, so that there you've got, there may be a cloudiness, but for the rest of you, the great American novels you're working on, while trying to pay attention in other classes, attention, probably belong not to Touro Law Center. Now, I don't know what the rest of your work life is about. In theory, someone else could have a claim. But if that's the case, if it's a work prepared by an employee within the scope of his or her employment, it is automatically, upon creation, owned by the employer. This is not like the shop right of patent law. There is no assignment necessary. There's no inventor's claim. Yeah.
Do you know how law review works? Do they ask for an assignment of the copyright, or do they?
I haven't the slightest idea how our law review works. I would imagine that if anybody thought about it, there may be. As part of the condition of being named to law review, I don't know if you signed anything or there was any sort of terms of law review editoring status, If you're just writing for the law review, there's probably a publication agreement. But it's less of a concern, I think. That said, it should be dealt with. And if you guys know more and we're not dealing with it properly, let me know, because I'll... Well, take a look. If not, I mean, I can talk to the faculty advisors. I suspect the intention is that there's a transfer, but you're right. You're not employed.
Yeah.
So this doesn't apply by default.
But they do pull on staff. And
what they call you is irrelevant. This is a legal status issue. The legal status of an employee generates the legal rights or the legal transfer of rights instantly without further activity.
I know that if you got published, there was no signature required or any documentation that you had to sign. And I know when I put things on the website, it's kind of billed as a benefit of being published and being part of the law review.
The issue is not for you. The issue is making... It's not so much that the law center necessarily needs ownership, but in theory, the law center needs a license in order to reproduce that document in different forms and perhaps provide it to the databases to put online, etc. So that's why I hope for everyone's benefit, someone has figured this stuff out, whether or not you've realized it, but it's probably worth thinking about. Irrelevant. Irrelevant. Totally irrelevant. Because this is the other category. So one possibility of an automatic workmate for hire is an employee in the context of his or her employment. The other is a work specially ordered or commissioned for use as a contribution to a collective work as part of a motion picture, other audiovisual work, as a translation, as a supplementary work, as a compilation, or as an instructional text, as a test, an answer material for a test, or as an atlas. Okay. If the parties expressly agree in a written instrument signed by them that the work shall be considered as a work made for hire. There are five really important words in this paragraph. Five legally crucial words, and they are? No, if is not. If is an important one.
Well, it's a condition.
It is. But it's the what the if is, and the five words. They are five words in sequence.
Shall be.
No. 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 Written instrument signed by them. Parties may agree up, down, and sideways. One party may pay the other. They may proclaim to the world that this is a work made for hire, and do you know what legal import that has? Almost none. Not entirely none. There may be some licenses implied by that. There might be indicia. But unless it's in writing, there is no transfer of ownership. Because even if there was, right, the artist was not, the sculptor was not an employee. The sculptor was a contractor.
Then there was no written instrument.
There may well have been a written instrument regarding, and I don't have the case here in front of me, regarding the services to be rendered, the description of the statue, the delivery date. All of that can be in writing or not. But unless there was a paragraph that said, in consideration for this, the artist hereby grants the client full right, title, and interest in this, and it shall be deemed a work made for hire. You don't say that, it doesn't happen. lots and lots and lots of companies and people who have hired creative people to do work for them. Paid or unpaid doesn't matter. Have discovered to their detriment when there is a dispute that what they thought they were getting was not what they actually received. What they received was the service. They may have received a copy of the work in question, but what they didn't get was ownership. Web developers, especially early on, and I know I keep coming back to that context, but it happens to be what I was doing for a living, and it also was an area where the rules weren't as clear-cut. It's not that the law wasn't there, but that the people doing it weren't necessarily as familiar, and the people hiring people to do it were clearly not as familiar with the ins and the outs. And there weren't established types of agreements that everybody knew you used. There was no Blumberg form for web development agreements. And so, in situation upon situation upon situation, there would be a dispute between clients and developers, and the clients would say, we don't want to pay, and the developers, who might have had a, you know, a semester of law school or had a buddy or whatever, would say, really? Guess what? We never signed ownership of the website. It's ours under federal copyright law, and we can just keep it or give it to your competitors. And they could. This little five-word phrase, written instrument signed by them, has been the cause of more disputes in creative services than you can possibly imagine. Because without it, the best that the customer can say it has is an implied or express license. And that's not always enough. Because that license may not permit them to sublicense or to sell that asset later on or whatever. So if your clients are hiring people to do any kind of copyright generating work for them, painters, sculptors, developers, musicians, composers, whatever, and your client needs to have ownership, doesn't always, but if your client needs to have ownership going forward, it is mandatory that you provide in writing the transfer of that work, the ownership of that work. Because if you don't, you didn't. And it's a real, real problem. So it's not just the writing, it's the magic words. Yeah. Shall be deemed a work made for hire under the Copyright Act. That's what the words say, that's what they need to say. Because it's not just an assignment, it is a transfer of full right and title. It's important. And it is different, and it matters. Because transferring of ownership means that those rights that were once held by party A are now held exclusively by party B. And A has them no longer. A can exercise no more control. That means B has the right to permit or prohibit people from doing all those things that copyright holders have the right to permit or prohibit. Copying, transmitting, public performance, adaptations, all that stuff. Also, selling the work as an asset requires owning it to begin with. And a license doesn't do that. Must be in writing in order for it to happen. Verbal transfer is not valid. As I said, it's a problem for web developers. So that is one key issue. And we see the issue in our cases. The issue of the assumptions that our clients may make. In the clicking through excerpt, I talk about the myths of copyright, and there are many of them, and they are completely and totally and powerfully held by people who should know better and don't. Lots of myths about creative works. I learned about them because when I started thinking about it for what became that book, I was in-house counsel at this web developer, and I had some very, very smart colleagues, creative, experienced, and they would say to me things about copyright that would blow my head off. I was like, you think what? You know, and I realized, and you need to realize, that there is a lot of just straight out misinformation about copyright. And if you doubt that, go ask a copyright question on the internet and see what you're told. Because everybody thinks they know. Here's another brilliant area of complete and utter misunderstanding. It has to do with fair use. So fair use is a defense. Fair use is a defense to infringement. There is an infringement, and the accused infringer says, yes, perhaps I have infringed your rights, but I do not face liability because fair use. The problem with that idea is that it is fairly difficult, pardon the pun, somewhat difficult to figure out fair use definitively outside of a courtroom. Because the statute doesn't define it. The statute, there are certain exceptions in the copyright law itself. Section 110, for example, contains a nice little exception to infringement for the display and public performance of legal copies of motion pictures by in a not-for-profit classroom setting. If I have a legal copy of a movie, even if I'm not supposed to show it in public, and I'm here and I'm with you, I am permitted by Section 110A to show it to you. There is a clear-cut carve-out for that particular use. There's a clear-cut carve-out from the need to license for public performances if the public performance of the work is done on home stereo quality equipment. Which is a little, if you look at it, there are definitions in the statute, and in fact, that caused a whole trade dispute because that's not one of those things that you find in other countries' copyright laws. But that's why if you've got a restaurant or a bar and you just put up a boombox or the equivalent, you don't have to get public performance rights. But if you set up a professional sound system, you do. It's a little bit of a vague distinction, but at least the concept is clear cut in the statute. If you fit into this definition, you don't have to worry about clearance. This, less so. Because what 107 gives us is not a definition. But factors for a court, for a fact finder to use to determine as part of the determination of fair use. So what is the court or the determiner supposed to use? Well, here's one. The purpose and character of the use, including whether such use is of a commercial nature or is for non-profit educational purposes. Again, that's not a fair that's not a safe harbor. That's just a factor to be weighed. What else? The nature of the work. The amount and substantiality of the portion used in relation to the copyrighted work as a whole. How much of it did you take? How important was that bit? That's how, for example, well, I was going to say Siskel and Ebert, but now it's Roper and whomever and all those people and your local news movie reviewer. How is it that they can show scenes from movies without needing to license every film, especially the ones that aren't now yet available for licensing? That. Because they're only showing clips. And it has been determined over time that that type of use in conjunction with the other factors falls under fair use. But if movie critic person, well, I can tell you a specific example. So you have movie critic on the one hand, right? And you have, anyone know what Riff Trax is? Can you share with the class what Riff Trax is? So you may recall Mystery Science Theater 3000. The people who did that don't own the brand anymore. That's why it's not called Mystery Science Theater 3000. They call it Riff Trax. All right, gentlemen?
I'm trying to think. There was a famous case on this was the Ford one, right?
There was a...
on fair use, where they took...
I think it was a pre-publication of someone's memoirs. And they. But we're sort of riffing on Riff Trax at the moment.
I think
Nixon.
So, but back to Riff Trax. So on the one hand, you have film critics who show you clips, and maybe they make fun of them. On the other hand, you have Riff Trax that show the whole film, and you make fun of them. And I know, because I have a son who's big into Riff Trax, that they do two things. Either they record their commentary and make you buy a copy of the film yourself, sort of like Dark Side of the Moon and The Wizard of Oz. You're supposed to start them together. Or they actually do theater performances. There's one in Westbury that I've dropped my son off more times. And they will license a film. But sometimes they don't get the film they wanted. So there was one recently where they wanted something, but ultimately they couldn't get the rights and they ended up getting Starship Troopers instead. They did Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. So for them, they're showing the whole film and they do need to get the rights because they're using the whole thing. Yes, they're talking over it, but it doesn't stop you from watching the whole film. You do want to look at the effect of the use upon the potential market for or value of the copyrighted work. So there's no bright line test here. And there are lots of really odd cases about this sort of thing. The classic one, and I'm not going to dig out, you can listen to it on YouTube or whatever yourself. That whole idea of listening on YouTube is its own interesting story. But the classic copyright infringement case where it's two songs and they're not the same song, except they are. lyrics are totally different, but there's a significant riff in the first that ends up note for note in the second. And the guy who did the second really didn't need the money. The original song is He's So Fine by some Motown girl group. I always get that wrong. Shirelles, Rondells, Yodels, I don't know what. And George Harrison's My Sweet Lord. And it's the same riff. And Harrison didn't need to copy them and probably didn't intend to copy them. But the court decided that the piece he took, however subconsciously he did it, and they acknowledge, but it was substantially similar. It's not the whole song, but it's the important part of the song. Think about, let's say Beethoven was still protected by copyright. Eight notes. You don't think eight notes would be a really significant portion of a song, right? Da-na-na-na, da-na-na-na. It's a pretty important part of the song. So that's what they talk about, the amount and substantiality. It's not just how much, but is it the key part of the film or the work used as in relation to? So, but fair use is not clear cut. There is, by the way, if you want to... If you're interested in fair use, I thought I might have it here. I don't. There is a comic book, and it is available without restriction. Bound by Law: Tales from the Public Domain. Trapped in a Struggle She Didn't Understand by Daya Filmmaker. By night, she fought for fair use. Worth Tracking Down from Duke Law. It's a fun read, it's short, it's quick, but it really looks at, this is actually from a law school, looks at these issues and how difficult it can be for well-meaning people, well-intentioned people, to do the right thing, to know what their right thing is. Now, of course, there's one of the other exceptions that has developed to copyright infringement is the parody exception. That the idea of taking something and using it for humor in a humorous way, in a transformative humorous way, is an exception. That's how you may do a parody song, even if you don't have permission from the copyright holder, as long as it is a legitimate, actual parody. So, for example, the king of the well-orchestrated parody songs, Weird Al Yankovic, who I love, he actually voluntarily seeks permission from all the artists whose music he parodies, but he probably doesn't have to, because no one would dispute that Weird Al's work is a parody, except for the few original songs that he's done, and there are people that have actually parodied him, which is kind of fun. Anyway, did you have your hands up, or... Right. They were not successful at that. And that was, I think, because...
They shut down for health reasons.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so that was... But there you're not talking about copyright. There you're talking about trademark. And trademark parody is a parallel but somewhat different genre, right? Well, you tell me, is a recipe copyrighted? Is the the recipe as contained in a drink copyrighted?
Probably not.
No. If anything, it's a patent, if it's anything, right? No, it can't be. But this is where we have problems with clients. Because there are all these myths. You know? I didn't have to pay for it, so it must be free to use. Nothing stopped me from downloading the image, so it must be permissible. It doesn't look like it used to. I was going to talk about derivative works tonight, so I don't want to forget that. So if you recall, one of the exclusive rights there we go. Prepare derivative works. I said I'd come back to this. This one is really important to understand. Once a copyrighted work is created, the owner of that copyright automatically owns the copyright in any derivation of that work. Unless there is some sort of license or other kinds of things. But, so a photograph that is turned into a painting, someone paints the photograph, the original copyright holder, generally speaking, holds the work, holds the copyright in the photograph, regardless of who took it. Sorry, the photograph holder owns the right in the painting. Should say. There are exceptions in the law for so-called transformative works, but that exception can be very broadly abused. So there are some famous examples, if you haven't seen these, of derivative works. Oh, look at this. Shepherd Fairey, I must have used this computer before. Shepherd Fairey, famous poster and other artist, right? Among his most famous works, they don't even have a picture of it here, this article. Okay, let's, can someone please give me a picture? Shepherd Fairey is the create, what is this? Away. I don't want to do that. It's the creator of the ubiquitous Hope poster from the 2008 presidential campaign of Barack Obama. Look familiar? I think we've seen this once or twice. Inspirational, Hope, nice colors. Creative work. Except, it wasn't his image. Oh, come on. There was a photo from which Fairey took his poster. And here's the photo. This was a photo by an Associated Press reporter at an event prior to the campaign. This is the Shepherd Fairey poster. Now, who doesn't have a claim in this? What? Correct. Because as a famous newsworthy person, he doesn't really get to object to this sort of thing. But, and it's not as if the claim was that Shepherd Fairey could not create a poster of then Senator Obama. The problem, though, was that he didn't just create a poster. Nor did he take his own photograph and paint from it, which would have been fine. Instead, he took this photograph and copied its lighting, its angle, the facial expressions. There is no question, but this is the source, and he has admitted it after first hiding evidence and obstructing justice, and that's why he ended up getting sentenced to probation, because not because of the civil action from the AP, but the criminal contempt charge when he tried to hide the fact that this was the source.
Changing the tie colors.
No, that's a derivative work. Why does J.K. Rowling make a huge amount of money? Because J.K. Rowling not only perhaps holds the copyrights to the stories of Harry Potter, but any adaptation from those stories, Rowling has the rights to. Doesn't have to fight for them, she holds them. So these myths, and that one, so if your client takes a photograph and transforms it in all the fun digital Photoshop-y GIMP ways, that doesn't change the copyright of the original photograph. It only makes it less likely that your client will get caught. It is not legal. There's no percentage of the image where if you take this much of it rather than this much, there's a legal line. There is none. Yeah.
Unless it's a parody, right?
Unless it's a parody, right. Parody exception. So if you took this poster and you said infringement, right? Shepard Fairey would likely not have rights against you because you were making humorous social commentary. Like these, right? They were sort of, this is probably showing how you transform things. Photographs to become sculptures. That is a derivative work. And so on and so on and so on. Wait, first of all, right of publicity is a state privacy right?
Right? Like this, and I could definitely give a couple of cases where the, like, I just know off the top of my head, there was a comic book with Edgar Winter, and he was used as a, his depiction was used, and Edgar Winter was an albino, and had certain traits, he was a rock star.
There's a difference, though. He doesn't have a copyright. This is about copyright. Do not get confused, because there are situations where there's no copyright protection, but there are other protections. Did I tell you guys the moon story? Okay, because this was another one of these copyright stories. All U.S. government works have no copyright attached to them, public domain. But the people that are shown in the pictures may still have rights of publicity. And the astronauts in the first moon landing, Buzz Aldrin in particular, in that famous space helmet reflection out, you know, you see that picture of him standing on the moon with the Earth in the background. He claims rights of publicity in that photo, because I once had to negotiate with him for this, or at least his people, even though you can't see his face, because there's no other person it could have been. So it's not a copyright issue. Right of publicity, separate, often connected. I had a client who used a stock photo of these three old guys in a 1950s computer lab for an ad. We made sure we had indemnification from the stock photo house because they couldn't give us clearance. They had copyright. They couldn't give us rights of publicity clearance. And lo and behold, the client took the ad out, got a letter from this 80-year-old guy. I was so thrilled to see my picture in your ad. And thank God we had asked for releases from the stock photo house in case he decided to sue. Not a copyright issue. So when you're talking about having your face in a work, it's not a copyright, it's a right to use your own face. Same with video games. But that's why Obama had no claim here. So we're going to go on next class talking about trademark if you have any other questions. But do track down that Duke University fair use comic if you have trouble finding it. Let me know, and go home before the snow starts.